Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of the Sydney Writers' Festival. You're listening to a live recording from Rosalind Packer Theatre at the 2017 Festival.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to this session of the Sydney Writers' Festival, which is being live streamed around Australia, and so I'd like to welcome the audience wherever you are. My name's Jason Steger. I edit the books pages in The Age newspaper and pop up on the ABC TV's The Book Club. Hisham Mattar is a man of three countries, but in his heart lies really just one, Libya. He was born in 1970 in New York, while his father was first secretary of the Libyan mission at the UN. 3 years later, the family returned to Libya, where they lived until 1979, when Hisham's father, Jabalo, who was prominent in the opposition to the Gaddafi regime, was forced to flee to Cairo. In 1990, he was plucked from the streets of the Egyptian capital by the secret police and delivered into the hands of the Libyans. He disappeared into the gloom of the infamous Abu Salim prison in Tripoli. His fate is uncertain, but it's assumed that he died in a mass shooting of 1,270 prisoners on June the 29th, 1996. Hisham went to Britain at the age of 12 for education and university and still lives in London. He's published two novels, In the Country of Men, which was shortlisted for the Booker Prize, and Anatomy of Disappearance. Both have young boys at their core, both dealing with an absent father. Last year, he published The Return, Fathers, Sons, and the Land in Between, which chronicled his first trip back to Libya, the story of his search over the years for the truth about his father's fate, and examined how he himself negotiated the absence of a man who was a significant moral figure in the lives of many. And The Return also delves into his own relationship with Libya and what it means to him. The book is beautiful, gentle, and quite shocking. It has a structure that takes the reader back and forth in time, back, for example, to the early life of his grandfather, who lived to be over 100 and had fought against the Italian occupation. And then it takes us up to the hopes of the Libyan spring and the overthrow of Gaddafi. If Hisham appears somewhat jet-lagged, we can forgive him. He arrived here only on Thursday night, having popped over to America from his home to pick up the Pulitzer Prize for biography, which he won for The Return. He then went back to London. But wait, there's more. He then went back to London and then the next day flew to Sydney. And while he was en route, he was announced as the winner of the £20,000 Rathbones Folio Prize in the UK. So, two prizes in 2 days is pretty good going, I reckon. Please welcome Hisham Mattar. Hisham, perhaps you might like to read just a little bit to give the audience a good idea of the book, and then I'll give you a grilling.
Okay, good. Well, good afternoon, everyone. Thank you so much for coming. This is my second time in Sydney. Last time was 5 years ago in 2012, and it's just so lovely being back. It's such a wonderful city, and I'm being treated so nicely. Everybody's so kind, and so I'm filled with appreciation and gratitude, and also appreciation and gratitude to the organizers, to the Sydney Writers' Festival, and to that marvelous silent army of volunteers that make everything possible. So. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So I will read from the beginning. I won't introduce it for that reason. Early morning, March 2012, my mother, my wife Diana, and I were sitting in a row of seats that were bolted to the tiled floor of a lounge in Cairo International Airport. Flight 835 for Benghazi, a voice announced, was due to depart on time. Every now and then, my mother glanced anxiously at me. Diana, too, seemed concerned. She placed a hand on my arm and smiled. I should get up and walk around, I told myself. but my body remained rigid. I had never felt more capable of stillness. The terminal was nearly empty. There was only one man sitting opposite us. He was overweight, weary-looking, possibly in his mid-50s. There was something in the way he sat, the locked hands on the lap, the left tilt of the torso, that signaled resignation. Was he Egyptian or Libyan? Was he on a visit to the neighboring country or going home after the revolution? Had he been for or against Gaddafi? Perhaps he was one of those undecided ones who held their reservations close to their chest. The voice of the announcer returned. It was time to board. I found myself standing at the front of the line, Diana beside me. She had, on more than one occasion, taken me to the town where she was born in Northern California. I know the plants and the color of the light and the distances where she grew up. Now I was, finally, taking her to my land. She had packed the Hasselblad and the Leica, her two favorite cameras, and 100 rolls of film. Diana works with great fidelity. Once she gets hold of a thread, she will follow it until the end. Knowing this excited and worried me. I'm reluctant to give Libya any more than it has already taken. Mother was pacing by the windows that looked onto the runway, speaking on her mobile phone. People, mostly men, began to fill the terminal. Diana and I were now standing at the head of a long line. It bent behind us like a river. I pretended I had forgotten something and pulled her to one side. Returning after all these years was a bad idea, I suddenly thought. My family had left in 1979, 33 years earlier. This was the chasm that divided the man from the 8-year-old boy I was then. The plane was going to cross that gulf. Surely such journeys were reckless. This one could rob me of a skill that I have worked hard to cultivate, how to live away from places and people I love. Joseph Brodsky was right. So were Nabokov and Conrad. They were artists who never returned. Each had tried in his own way to cure himself of his country. What you have left behind has dissolved. Return and you will face the absence or the defacement of what you treasured. But Dmitry Shostakovich and Boris Pasternak and Naguib Mahfouz were also right. Never leave the homeland. Leave and your connections to the source will be severed. You'll be like a dead trunk, hard and hollow. What do you do when you cannot leave and cannot return? Thank you.
So, Hisham, I mean, you call the book The Return, but it's more than just a literal return to Libya for you, isn't it? You say in the book that all your life, since you were 8, you've been waiting to return. What did the return mean? What did it represent for you? What were you returning to?
Well, I know the answer to that question in retrospect. I always find it interesting how the present, and I don't think I'm alone in this, I think most of us are like that. The present for us is a space of unknown possibilities. It seems like we implicate ourselves into situations without really knowing what's going on. At least that was for me the case. I had on the surface very rational reasons to go back, you know, yearnings for the places that I remembered that were vivid in my mind, yearnings for the people that I grew up with and wasn't able to see for that period of time, and maybe yearning for something else that is slightly more difficult to describe, which is that exile sometimes, and exile here I define it in a very specific way. I don't mean just living away from your country, but I mean not being able to return to your country for whatever reason. And some of the effects that has is it feels as if your the linear line of your narrative has been amputated, you know. And so maybe the other yearning or the other secret wish that was somehow for things to be reconnected, for the old rivers to flow into the new ones, you know, for there to be a kind of connection between that past and the life that I made for myself, living in Britain and living inside the English language. And but when I went back, I also realized something that I didn't, had you asked me before, Libby, I would have said, of course, I don't see the world that way. But when I went back, I realized what you mentioned, that I was waiting. Mm-hmm. But I also was like a stowaway who had this romantic idea that one day there'll be this island in the distance called Libya, and I would get there and all of my existential questions will be resolved.
Right.
Right. But of course, once I arrived there, I am returning, of course, in the literal sense, as you described, but also the return exposes the distances that I've traveled, and it exposes the kind of man that I've become.
The changes that have been wrought on you by being outside Libya.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, I describe it in the world, that in the book, that, you know, one of the curious outcomes is that it somehow, I felt an increased appetite for the world.
Having returned back.
And it made me think that maybe that is one definition of home. Mm. Home is a place from which you travel.
Yeah, and you have that security of identity.
Yes, maybe. I mean, the word identity is very complicated, isn't it? And it's sort of, it's certainly not security, but because it's still dynamic and volatile, that relationship. But you know, when you're not allowed to reconnect to something, you fall into the traps of maybe idealizing it. You know, maybe, you know. So it was a return to a more material world, you know, a world of the reality of my relationship to it, which might not be might not adhere to the idealized vision, but it's much more welcome because it's the real, no?
Yeah.
I mean, it's like any relationship that you want to have, whether with a place or with a person, you want it to be in the present. You want it to be informed by the present, mm-hmm. not informed by something in the past.
I was interested, talking about the present, though. I mean, obviously, the return is very much about your father. But there's one point when you talk about your mother and you describe her as the real radical because she is interested in the present, whereas your father was interested in the past and also the future, what Libya would become.
Yes.
What did you mean by your mother being the radical?
Exactly that my mother was focused on the present.
Hmm.
On the, you know, on what needs to happen now.
Mm.
And, you know, there's a lot of things that I'm not very good at, you know, but one thing that I am good at, and I've learned it from my mother, is that life is for the living, you know. And that's partly what I mean by being in the present, you know. That, you know, you don't let the burdens of the past or your aspirations for the future abstract the tender, rich qualities of the present, you know, and make you hurried and, you know, so.
But the book obviously is very much about your father. Could you just tell us a bit about him? Why, I mean, he sounds, from reading it, a truly remarkable man, a poet, a political activist, a committed anti-Gaddafi activist to the extent of funding with the family fortune, if you like, an armed uprising, and funding people in Chad who were going to start something, were going to move into Libya. Was, in a sense, the book also a discovery for you of your father?
You know, it's very interesting when you say to me, you know, tell me about your father or describe your father. Something happens to me, Jason. It's sort of, I just kind of become, it's like I'm in a fog.
Mm.
I can't see him. And I think it is something that is not just unique to my relationship to my father, but I think it's something to do with the nature of intimacy that the people that you know very well or think you know very well are also the most mysterious, the most unknowable. And so I wanted to, in the book, I wanted to cultivate a clear-eyed, direct gaze at my father, as at the man, you know. Everything, you know, I mean, he's, yes, you're right. He was wasn't a very good poet, my father.
He wasn't
a very good poet. I used to tease him about it. But he was an excellent reader.
Yeah.
And he had this incredible memory for literature. I mean, library. He had a library in his head.
Yeah, he said to you, knowing a book by heart is like carrying a house inside your chest.
Yeah.
Which is, yeah, it's a wonderful,
yes,
absolutely wonderful.
Yeah, and I know from other people who were in prison with him that this became a source of companionship, that he would recite these poems at night. One of the motivations behind the book is to sort of try to describe him more fully, but he was a complex person and a result of that generation that was, you know, committed to the dream, the Republican dream, which was seen as the extension of the project of independence. Mm. And so he was a senior military officer under the king and respected the king, but he was a Republican. And so when the coup happened, the Gaddafi coup happened, he was enthusiastic until very quickly it became clear that this was a dark time because Gaddafi tore up the constitution, announced himself de facto leader forever, and so my father was he retreated from working as a diplomat and then became a dissident.
One of the discoveries that you made when you went back was, in fact, you discovered some stories of your father. So he wasn't simply a poet, was he?
Yeah, no, he was actually a much better prose writer than he was a poet. He wrote.
And you hadn't known that, had you?
I didn't know that. I discovered it when I went to Libya that he had written these short stories when he was, I don't know when he wrote them, but they were published when he was 18. And they were wonderful, you know. And it was a very strange moment because time had somehow been turned upside down. Because there I was in my early 40s, reading the stories of a young lad who was yet to become my father, and seeing how I might be able to help him. You know, had he come to me, I might have helped him.
What would you have said to him?
I would have said maybe, you know, restrain this part here, you're going a little bit too far, this one. But also I would have known what books to recommend because I could see where his enthusiasms were.
Yeah.
I might have gotten him a subscription to some of the better journals. You know? So it was a very strange moment.
Yes.
At the same time, it was very powerful because nothing gives away the DNA of a writer like his prose. You know, prose contains the mentality, the tempo, the nature, the color of a man's soul, right? Or a woman's soul, the writer's soul. Mm. And so it also was this surprising, you know, unexpected privileged access to the young man that was to become my father that no, you know, photograph would have given me, right? I mean, it was something very, very special.
And the attempt to establish precisely what happened to him, I mean, that wasn't, I mean, it's, was the book, it's not really an exercise in catharsis for you, is it? Because, I mean, you wrote a diary in the London Review of Books the other day, and in it you said, writing only works when you stop using it as a weapon.
Mm.
So there's there's no sense of you attacking the Libyan regime in this, really, other than obviously for what they did to your father. But you say also, you said when we talked before, you said you have to surrender all your causes, your ambition at the door when you walk into literature. But what did you get from writing the book?
Well, you know, there's of course, like all of us, there are different colors to me. You know, I'm also a citizen who feels passionately about certain issues, and I exercise my political rights. But as an artist, I feel that it's inappropriate. That in other words, it would be betrayal. It would be like just to have like the sort of the bitter taste of treachery if you use your work in order to advance your causes, no matter how noble they are, right? Because or how urgent they are. Because I think that it feels, and this is not an intellectual argument, huh? This is what's interesting about it for me, is that it's not an intellectual argument. It's not like I sat and thought this out and thought that is the right way to do it. It was more just experientially, as I sit and work, I feel employed by the work. Mm-hmm. And the thrill of writing prose for me is how, when you encounter a book, because, you know, I do think your book is your fate, and you encounter a book, and the book needs everything from you. Mm-hmm. You know, it's better than you. Mm. You need to step up to it. That's just a thrilling thing. And you know it's an accident. I mean, or you know that it is, whatever it is, an accident, it's good fortune, good luck. I don't know what it is. But when you read the history of literature, you read great writers who never had that. They didn't have the good luck of meeting a book that was their match or better than them. And you read other writers who are very good but had the good fortune for some reason to encounter a book that was truly greater than them, you know?
Such as?
I mean, I always think of Flaubert and Turgenev in this, you know. These are two old friends. They, over a period of, I think, 14 years, wrote letters to one another weekly. It's a wonderful thing to do if you go and find the book in the library of their letters. And if you were a betting man, you would, you know, look at them early on, you'd put money on Turgenev, because there was the great, you know, incredible intellect, super cultivated, speaks all these languages, involved in the complicated world of Russia at that time and the end of serfdom, and coming from a family that had a lot of serfs, but he was against the system in very complicated places he occupied intellectually and politically. And just the most refined writer, you know, of his time. And he wrote marvelous books, but nothing really that matches his. And Flaubert, starting out, you think, yes, no, he's a good runner, you know, he's a good writer, but ended up writing truly great books, you know. So it's quite interesting, that subject in general. But and this is, please, not for a moment am I saying that this book is, my book is good, or because I really have no idea, you know.
It is good. Trust me. Don't listen to him.
But I also don't have an idea, for an interesting reason, because it's impossible for me to read it in that way, in that objective way. Anyway, that aside, the book then starts to govern your preoccupations. It decides what I'm interested in. It decides what, even down to like what sort of music I might be more likely to listen to. Really? What sort of company I'd be more inclined to cultivate, you know?
During the writing of it.
During the writing, and very subtly, of course, nothing too extreme, but, you know, you could notice how the 3 years of The Return are different from the 3 years or 4 years of Anatomy of a Disappearance.
Really?
You know, that thing, right? And so it does feel like a presence in your life. That's sort of the thing that I treasure most, and I find so fascinating about the process. And that's why, if I were then to use that for my own intentions, even good intentions, it would feel like a betrayal.
But the consequence of your father being kidnapped by the Egyptians and then being in prison was you didn't know. You had a couple of letters from him, but you really didn't know about his fate. And so that turned you that turned you into a campaigner eventually, didn't it? You say that when Gaddafi took my father, he placed me in a space not much bigger than the cell father was in. But you then, you launched a pretty, a significant campaign to find, particularly to find out information about him and your other relatives who were also in prison. The campaign, how did you react though when the British government started dealing with the Gaddafi regime? I mean, that must have been on the one hand, you must have thought, well, this could be a way in. But on the other hand, it must have been ghastly for you. There they were trying to suck up to this terrible man and his terrible regime.
I mean, yes. I mean, the two sides of myself, my British and Libyan side, were engaged in a deeply corrupt, parasitic relationship. It was very upsetting. But I was very, I had developed a kind of pragmatic attitude to use the situation best I can to secure the whereabouts of my father, to place pressure on the Libyan government to advance on human rights reform. I didn't succeed, but that was the mentality. That was what I was thinking about. But you know, a lot of this stuff is quite interesting in what it exposed about the nature of relationships. Like at the moment of the campaign, the most developed moment in the campaign, you know, it was 3 months where every week there was either an article, something on the radio, something on television, every week about the human rights situation in Libya. And we secured the support of wonderful human rights lawyers, members of the House of Lords, writers, lots of people really gathered around the campaign. And at that moment, you would look at me and you'd say, there goes a very good son. That is the moment when you are as loyal as you can be to your father. Yet, and I don't understand why, it was during that time that I felt very far away from my father. Couldn't somehow even conjure his voice or image in my head. And I don't know why that's the case, but it might be, one of the reasons might be that when you are looking for your father, you are of course looking for your father, but you're also looking for other things. You know? And in the middle of that heated time, I have a dream of him. I fall asleep in our living room, just fatigued. I went for 3 months with very little sleep. And then I would have this strange thing where I would just collapse for 12 hours. And then I would go again for 5 days with very little sleep and so on. So it was during one of these kind of, you know, unconscious moments. And I dreamt, it was a strange dream because the room was exactly the way it was. Where the papers are, cup of tea that is on the floor, all that. And I dreamt that he walked into the room and he was disappointed. And he said, you know, you just haven't been paying me enough attention lately. You know? And it's a very curious dream. Really? I mean, that's all I'm doing, man. What are you talking about? But he was right, because I focused so much on the campaign that all I was thinking, my father became only in my mind the political prisoner, you know? And that is one of the negative side effects, the very painful side effects of political oppression, or oppression between people, you know? So somebody's abused somehow, even in a domestic situation, is that because you feel so strongly about the injustice, that they become, in a sense, interwoven in the injustice. So that was a revelation for me because, I was obsessed, you know, an obsession. You know, it's a word that people use a lot. No, it's even made its way into advertisements, and there's even a cologne, I think, called Obsession. No, so it's like, you know, that's, you could only name a cologne Obsession if you don't know what the meaning of that word is. It's a it's a dark tunnel. It gets you nowhere. It's a vacuum of, you know, it sucks all the energy, and you want something much more. You know, there's, you want light and movement. That doesn't mean that you cannot continue to be vigorous in your search, but something much more, you know, where he starts to appear to you before anything else, before being a political prisoner or anything, as a man. Mm. You know?
I mean, obviously, you're very interested in the relationship between, as I've mentioned, between fathers and sons, and both your novels deal with that as well, and they seem to be refracted through the your own experience of your father disappearing. But of course, there's another in The Return. There's another interesting father-son relationship, and that is between Gaddafi and his son Saif al-Islam. And when the campaign was at sort of at its pitch, you had direct dealings with Saif al-Islam in London, and that was that's a sort of slightly surreal business. Yes. in the book. Mm. And what astonished me talking to you was that you had some sympathy for him, some as a son.
Yes, I mean, I like to think, I'm not always good at it, but I like to think I have sympathy for almost anybody, because...
But for the man, the son of the man maybe who's especially, tortured your father?
Maybe especially. Look, it's very, you know, because of the situation about my father and what he went, and this terrible burden of not knowing what happened to him, it is right to think of me as having had a tough time being my father's son. But actually, equally true, maybe even more true, it is very easy being my father's son. It's very convenient. You know, he was a good man, and he was brave in a time that it was difficult to be brave. You can't reasonably ask people to be that brave. It's too much of a risk, you know. He was, you know, tender and loving and interesting and generous. And, you know, if I think back of my time with my father, it's mainly colored with delight, you know. He was a delight to be with. Mm-hmm. And so that's all very easy. That's very easy to live with that. It's very freeing. There's nothing that I wish I had told him this. I wish I'd, you know, I was very able to, our relationship allowed me great facility to express my love and passion and curiosity and to have vigorous arguments with him, and, you know, all of that was, range was broad, no? So on all levels, the personal level, the political level, the moral level, it is very easy being his son. The other stuff is difficult, you know, his disappearance and so on. So that then takes me to a place where I think, well, what if I were the son of the man who tortured my father? That's much more complicated. I mean, imagine that. Imagine your father as a torturer. And it's a complete accident that I am the son of Jaballah Matar and Saif al-Islam is the son of Gaddafi. It's a complete accident. And there are structural things that are placed on us that in this situation. I'm not exonerating him of personal responsibility for a minute. I think he should stand in front of the Court of Human Rights. It is, maybe sympathy is the wrong word. Maybe it's imagination. No, because then otherwise you fall into their lexicon. You know. The lexicon of the dictatorship is condemn this person. Yes. Forget this person. Is, you know, there's no exercise of the imagination. So the question is at the heart of what does it mean to oppose? What does it mean to oppose? Is it just a binary thing? Or is it much more, you know, spiritually and intellectually and emotionally, psychologically, intense business.
Yes, yes. But it was a weird time dealing with him, wasn't it?
Yes, it was the most difficult thing for me. I've never had to. And this was truly the most difficult thing, to sit across the table from somebody whose entire stature, the clothes on their back, everything comes from this regime that has oppressed so many people, not just my father. That's very, very difficult.
And he could have, just like that, he could have told you exactly what had happened to your father.
Yes, and he it was important for him to let me know that the information was always with him. Yes. And that he just can't tell me or won't tell me until maybe I do this or do that. So we were playing a very dangerous game that he was much more experienced at than I was, because this is a regime that has bought a lot of people, burnt a lot of people, broke a lot of people. And so I was smart and I hope honorable, but I wasn't experienced. You know, this was very, very dangerous work. And so what I wanted was, I wanted to get him to confirm the whereabouts of my father and other prisoners had disappeared. What he wanted is to get rid of the noise I was making. To him, it was purely a PR problem. Mm-hmm. And to me, it was something else. And to get me to come with him to Libya for come visit your country. And then there'll be a photo of, what better proof can you have for a reforming dictatorship than the son of a leading dissident going back. So this was, I survived. I wasn't, I didn't make the wrong move. But had it went on for longer, maybe I would have lost my balance, because there were certain moments when I wasn't myself steady, because it's quite intense. Somebody says to you, look, I have everything. I have the file. But all I need you to do is just call this guy and give him an interview. Mm. That's a very, very, difficult moment to... and this is why I think there's a genius to international law, because international law deems forced disappearance as equal to torture, not only of the person who's been made to disappear, but also their families. And the real genius of international law is that it also deems the people who were ordered to disappear the person also suffered torture. No, yeah, so it's very, it's quite a complex, I felt something close to being tormented, by this situation. At the same time, I discovered something that was only academic in my mind before, that my father used to tell us, but I didn't know it in the material. It wasn't tested, which was that, that there's nothing that power can give you. Don't go to power to ask for things. Just live honorably and, So, and as I was talking with this guy, I realized at one point, there's nothing he can give me. I mean, of course, he can give me these things, but they won't take or add anything my relationship to my father. And it was quite a discovery for me. And that discovery implicates you into that sympathy that you were talking about. Because then you realize he's also a product of this strange reality.
Yes. And then when you...
And who am I to say that if I were in his shoes, I would behave differently? I would like to think I would, but I have no proof of that.
And then you... towards the end of the book, you get virtual confirmation of your father's fate in the mass shooting, don't you? I mean, is there any doubt at all in your mind?
There's it's not confirmation, it's just through the laws of deduction that you think, well, that's most probably what happened, is that he died in that shooting, but there is no proof, evidence of he could have...
Because I was interested also in the way you talk about... you say that in The Anatomy of a Disappearance, Nuri, the main character, says, The truth is, I don't believe Father is dead, but I don't believe he is alive either. And you write in the return, I felt guilty too as I continue, and sorry, no, that's not right. You say, my father is both dead and alive. I do not have a grammar for him. He is in the past, present, and future. Is that the case still? Do you no longer have, you don't have a grammar for him, or has that, has, would you change that now?
No, I think that has changed. That was describing that particular time when I really didn't know, you know, there was still a chance. But it's obvious that my father is not alive. It's just what we don't know is how his life ended, where his remains might be.
Mm. When you were a child, you write that you used to see, you relate this to a conductor, I think Simon Rattle. You say that he always used to see things as music.
He used to hear music
in his head.
Yeah.
And you, for you, it was words and images.
Yes.
Does that mean you were inevitably going to be a writer?
I'm so amazed by being a human being. To me, it's just the most phenomenal thing. It's incredible, to be engaged in this enterprise of being a human being. It's incredible. And I don't want to be anything else. I'm so glad I'm a human being. You know? I'm thrilled. I think it's endlessly interesting. You know, and so I don't know what I was meant to be or what I would, you know, I'm just endlessly interested in lots of things, but it is the only thing that I did that felt authentic. I didn't feel like I was somehow acting or pretending. I trained as an architect. I worked as an architect, and I was competent. You know, I did reasonably well as an architect, but I always felt I was somehow out of my skin. You know, really. And then when I was writing, I did lots of different things to pay for my writing. I painted houses. I bought and sold things, and always legal things, always. But I always felt like I was just like it was just a means to something. No, I wasn't. But writing is, it's not always easy, of course, and that's part of the pleasure, that it is a real challenge. But I feel in my skin doing it, and a lot of things from childhood start to make sense. Like when my mother used to take me to my friend's house and I'd spend the night and she'd come collect me, the parents of my friend would always say something similar to, you know, he's wonderful, we hardly noticed him. And I was, you know, I was just kind of disappear. And so I was always very good at just watching and listening. I never understood it. I thought it's somehow a handicap that I'm not in the world enough.
So you were observing everybody and taking note of it at the same time?
Not consciously, but I was obviously fascinated by, you know, observing people, as I still am, because to me they're so unknowable, you know, they're so interesting. But also other things like, you know, this, what you mentioned is that for a long time I would have these words or an image or that is not connected to something in daily life.
And I suppose...
I used to, for a long time, not take them seriously. Mm. Writing has cultivated a kind of appreciation and seriousness towards the imagination for me. When I have something, when I have an image, I write it down. I don't... before I would say, yes, if it has legs, it will keep going. Forget it. The interesting thing, why I feel a gratitude towards my work is that it has cultivated in me, I'm not saying it has made me a better person, I'm not saying that for a minute, but it has cultivated in me a certain quality of attentiveness that I appreciate towards people, towards art, towards ideas, towards history, towards nature. And it has, and this is bizarre, Jason, given that we're talking about a memoir, but... is that I, on some level, I'm not interested in myself, you know? I don't think there's anything essentially interesting about my family or about my country or about myself. I don't. I think other people, to me, are far more interesting. But I write these things because they connect me to the things that we all feel, you know. I'm much more interested in that subterranean network of human emotions and psychologies and that we are all connected to, all of us. And so literature works that way. You find the particular to drill down to that. To those links, to those relationships.
So, and which certainly comes across in the novels as well, I think. I mean, you're very interested in the relationships between people and experience. I think we should probably, Hisham, take some questions from the audience and from the audience in the live stream. Ladies and gentlemen, there's a fixed mic at the bottom of these two aisles, and up the top there are also fixed mics. But I'll take, first of all, a question from the live stream. And Olivia wants to know, now that you've finished The Return, Hisham, do you think you'll continue writing non-fiction, or would you return to fiction, to novels?
I mean, I've already started writing a novel. I have no idea if it's going to work, but it's just so wonderful to be... in the teeth of a new book. It wasn't a conscious decision to write, okay, now I have to write a novel. It wasn't like that. It just happened that way. And I think what might explain why the distinction to me isn't as important. It's clear, the distinction is clear. This is a work of nonfiction. Those are made up. So that distinction is clear. Yet in the day-to-day work, it is very similar. You know, it leads me to conclude that I'm a prose writer. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm fascinated by the architecture of a paragraph, with what you can do with time in it. The way prose is deeply invested in time and in history, even if you're talking about, you know, a character alone in a room. Somehow the past is always there. I find the tool is prose, really.
There's a question over there.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Anna, hello. We met earlier. I signed a book for her.
Yes. Well, so my question is, you talk a lot in your novel about both feeling hopeful and being realistic and sort of negotiating a balance between those two things. And so I guess my question is about your hope for the region. And do you feel hopeful that sort of the Middle East and North Africa, in particular Libya, will sort of have this democratic transition? Or do you think that the conditions, be it corruption or the military or natural resource wealth, that have allowed these authoritarian regimes to persist for so long are just too strong?
That's a very good question. And it brings to mind someone that was mentioned earlier in the event earlier today, James Baldwin. And I think somewhere James Baldwin says that someone asks him, are you optimistic about the challenges ahead? And he said something along the lines of, yes, I'm optimistic, because to be a pessimist is to think that human life is a parasite. And I somehow I agree with Baldwin. You know, I have I'm not naive, and I know to some extent the incredible negative capabilities of the human heart. But I don't think human life is a parasite. I think there is a great deal of energy and hope amongst a lot of people. And the region is going through, and again, it's difficult to speak about this quickly, and it's not necessarily all that helpful to speak in generalities, but I must, that the region is going through incredibly, as you know, very, very difficult, tumultuous stage in its history. And so it requires a kind of pause in our judgment and an engagement in the details of that history and how it is, like everything, like today is a symptom of the past, to engage us into asking really what did happen, What were those revolutions? What was the nature of them? So as to help us to understand what's going on. And one possible definition of what happened, at least in Libya, is that it is a moment, a very unusual moment, where people stopped thinking of themselves as just attached to a family or to a street. But they were really part of a society, that what they did affected the collective, and what the collective did affected them. And that kind of dynamic relationship is very mature, particularly in a country that is not politically mature. And that happened in that small window of the revolution. And so I think of it a bit, I mean, I'm not, of course, I mean, you've gathered that by now already, that I'm not an enlightened human being. But the mystics speak about enlightenment, and one of the ways they speak about it is that on the way to enlightenment, there are glimpses. And I had never understood that. What does that mean? And then, so to bring it down to my ordinary, stupid level, it is, you know, like when you have a relationship with someone, a friend or maybe a lover, and then they do something. And it's not very big. It's something very small, and it passes. And you think, ah, that's, I'm not sure about them now. I'm not sure about them. Then maybe 2-3 years later, something bigger happens, and you think, oh, I've always known that. You know, I've always, right? So that maybe is the glimpse. And the revolution was a glimpse where collectively as a society, people saw a different way to be, to organize society, where there's accountability and where there's justice and democracy and an independent court of law and all that. To describe how all that dream was crushed and fragmented is very complicated, but I don't think that glimpse ever disappears. You know, things become cloudier and cloudier, but that glimpse is surprisingly resilient, you know, in the history of individuals, but also of societies. So that is, you know, one of the reasons I have hope. The other reason is just a lot of, if you watch a lot of the young people, what they're working on, what they want, what they are, how they're organizing, it's very, you know, that is very, very, very inspiring. But, of course, there are huge reasons to be sad and worried and, you know, disheartened also.
There's a question up there, I think. Oh, perhaps not. There what? Yes.
Hello. I just thought you might, I was wondering if you felt a lot of fear at all in the writing of your book and how you overcame that, if so, about persecution or just...
Yes. I not with The Return, because, you know, the history had changed, but with my previous, with my novels, yes. In The Country of Men, I felt quite... And I remember that particular afternoon when I'd finished an early draft. This is my first book, so I didn't even know what exactly I was doing. And it was first draft, it wasn't very good, and, you know, it took another 4 years to make it good, but that first draft, that afternoon, it was around 4 p.m., I finished it, and I don't know why, it's a strange thing to do, but I felt I should take a shower. I don't know why. So I went and took a shower, and the house we lived in then, the bathroom had a where the shower is, there was a window, and the sun was coming through. So I was in the shower, sorry to be incredibly descriptive about this, I was in there, don't worry, I'm not going anywhere, you know. But I was in the shower, the sun was on me, and the water was warm. Yet I was shivering, you know. I was really trembling from inside, because I had realized at that moment that I wrote about things that had never been written about before, and they could make life very, very complicated for me. And, you know, in the absence of courage, self-delusion is a fantastic tactic. So I said, no, it's not going to be published, nobody's going to... carried on working on the book. When it was published, 4 or 5 years later, it did have, you know... grave consequences. You know, I couldn't go back to Egypt for 5 years, so I couldn't see my family and my nephews and so on. And also when friends or relatives were from Libya visiting London, they, you know, they rather not see me, and I understood why. But it made it very isolating, you know. And the first time I gave an interview about the novel, and I wasn't talking politics; I was talking literature. But I had to use the word "the dictatorship." I said I had to use the phrase "the dictatorship." So the dictatorship, just saying it, was a crime punishable by death. Then just saying "the dictatorship," because it's not, according to them, is a so all of that was difficult, because it sends a strange gust through your rooms, you know, you feel ruffled by it, you know. But not with the return, I had different anxieties to do with just, you know, notwithstanding all the evidence, I'm a private person, and so writing very openly and very honestly about things that are, you know, very private was you know, in the beginning only difficult. And then the other difficulty was the book asked me to be patient, incredibly patient, about things that I'm very impatient about. So you know, those are just some okay, of the difficulties.
We've only got a few minutes, and we've got a couple of questioners left. So go ahead, please.
Excuse me. Hisham, I'm curious about your relationship with Arabic literature and also to see your fabulous book translated into Arabic and read through Libya and in Egypt would be wonderful. Is that a possibility?
Yes, the book is being is being translated now into Arabic. In fact, I just got the first draft and reading through it. And so I am yes, very much looking forward to that. My relationship to Arabic literature was very strong when I was a kid. I mean, all of my reading was mostly Arabic until about the age of 12 or 13, and then it started to switch because my education then switched to English. And it felt that I was always trying to catch up, you know. So I read it still, but you know, I also read English and French and Italian and German. Not in those languages, but I'm in translation.
I think this must be the final question, I suspect, but you never know.
Yes, okay, it's a very simple one. I was wondering about your view of the NATO intervention in Libya in 2011, which led to...
That's a simple question.
You have 1 minute in which to...
that's a complicated question because I would have to relay a lot of facts about it, because it's, you know, as an idea in the beginning, it wasn't a bad idea, but the way that it was done was not right.
Yeah. Okay, let's very, very quickly, and then we'll have to finish.
Hello, I just wanted to ask you, what is your feeling about a sense of national belonging for all of those who come back to the countries that really no longer exist? So the Libya you grew up in doesn't exist, and it will never exist. Where do you identify, and can you still identify with your original country?
I mean, I think that's such an important question for our time, because... The stating the obvious, you know, so many people now are in that situation where they're born somewhere but they grow up somewhere else, and they live inside a language that wasn't the language that their mothers spoke to them in, and you know, that is becoming more and more common, and will become more so, sadly, because of the nature of the extraordinary levels of displacement in our world. But, you know, I actually, when I was young, I saw it, because I think when you're a teenager, at least when I was a teenager, you know, your mind is given to binary kind of thinking. And so I was very, I wanted to consolidate things. Things that could not be consolidated troubled me. And so the fact that I was Arabic and living in the English language was confusing to me. And then, you know, as this situation continued, Oftentimes, I found it, difficult. You know, oh, I'm always translating from one thing to the other, and so on. But over time, I don't know. I mean, I don't really, I don't see it as a problem or as a contradiction or as a, something that needs to be consolidated. The opposite, actually. I find it fascinating that I am, both Libyan and British, that I live inside the English language, but I grew up with this other language. It's very interesting, and it allows, it, of course, provides a lot of limitations like any position, but it also provides a lot of facility because it allows you to see things from a different point of view. Not necessarily a better one, but it's just a different point of view. And yeah. Mm.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm sorry we've run out of time. In fact, we're over time. There's so much more in the return. I do recommend that you rush to the bookshop and buy it. Hisham will be signing copies of that and his novels in the Ruth Cracknell room. Meanwhile, please thank Hisham Matar.